So I work at Pottstown Middle School after school twice a week. I work with an organization called Strive. It's a mentorship program, and through some generous grants, we were able to purchase and create a number of recording studios at the middle school. There's a music studio and there's a podcast studio. And so my job is that twice a week after school, I take a group of 6 to 8 middle school students and we podcast. I teach them how to form a story, a narrative, how to interview people. We come up with topics that matter to them, and we record and we edit, and then it goes out into the world. It's wonderful. These, you know, 10, 11, 12-year-olds are being, hopefully, are internalizing the fact that their words matter, that their stories matter, that they themselves matter enough to be published on the internet. It has been a really life-giving year so far. This is our first full year doing this. And I've gotten to know the kids really well. They trust me. They like me. Every time I show up after school, it's like when a farmer shows up and all the chickens run to them, you know? And I always feel so good, my little crew that surrounds me and talks to me. And so here we are in March, and we've been doing this for a couple of months. And so we decided we were going to do a bigger episode, something that we actually have to research and not just talk, you know, on the spot about. And so we talked before about what we could possibly discuss, what they were interested in learning more about, a big, important issue, not anything silly, something that actually matters. And so what we had landed on is the mental health crisis among youth. So in order to help them prepare for this episode, I brought I put together 10 questions, 10 research questions on a piece of paper that had a space to write on it for them. And my plan was to hand it to them and send them home and say, in the next week, with whatever downtime you have, here are some suggested questions that you can Google to find some research and information to help us then do this more planned out episode next week. To me, this was completely innocuous. This is fun. This is great. I handed them these papers with questions that looked like short essay questions, and to the person, they all mutinied in front of me. One particular fifth grader refused to touch it. And anytime somebody put it in front of her, she threw it across the room. They said, no, no, we're not doing homework. We already have to do so much already. We are already so busy. You are not giving us homework. We are not doing this. We don't care. One girl said, I'll bet you $50 that nobody in this room even takes it home. Right? This is a fifth grader said that to me. And I was like, whoa, 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 whoa. People, this is supposed to be fun, this thing that we're doing. You're not being graded. You're not being judged on this. Can we settle down a little bit? And they would not. I accidentally, inadvertently, completely triggered this group of middle schoolers by handing them a worksheet and kind of jokingly calling it homework. And I didn't realize how high-strung they were until then. Question number 3 on there, by the way, was something to the effect of how does the pressure of school affect children's mental health? And I was like, look, you're doing it right here, number 3. We can do this together. But they refused. They refused to do anything with this worksheet. In fact, one girl at the end of the day said, I feel so bad for you, Mr. Zach. I'll take it home. I'll take this. I'm not going to fill it out, but I'll take it home. And then I found it on the floor downstairs, so she forgot to take it home. So instead of doing this, I turned on, I hit record, and I sat down with them at the table, and I said, can we please talk about what the thing that just happened here? Can we talk about the fact that you all had an absolute breakdown when I handed you homework during this after-school extracurricular deal? And the conversation that ensued basically for them revolved around the fact that school is so high pressure and school is a place where they are reminded that they're not good enough all the time, that they don't measure up. They're not the smartest in the class. They're not the best. They don't understand everything. Stuff is hard, and they're constantly reminded that they're not smart enough. So we got on this discussion of, oh, and then, of course, the classic, I'm never going to use any of this stuff in the real world. Which I said to them, and I have a whole little speech about this, is no, you will not. I have never used Pythagorean theorem in my life outside of school, or the quadratic equation, though it's still in there. The point of learning these things is to learn how to learn, not to learn the facts themselves. It is to create lifelong learners who now have the skills to learn things they actually care about as adults. It has nothing to do with the facts. It has everything to do with practicing learning. They didn't buy it. So I asked them, what would you like school to teach you instead? If not fractions, what would you like to learn? And they had a couple of odd things they definitely got from memes, like, we should learn how to do our taxes, which of course they wouldn't pay attention to anyway, because taxes are awful. But one kid said he thought school should teach survival skills, like how to hunt, how to start a fire with two sticks, basically, you know, Boy Scout 101. And all the kids in the room agreed. They said, oh, that would be really useful. That would be really useful if there's an apocalypse and we have to, you know, fend for ourselves in the apocalypse. And they all just agreed as if this was a normal sort of conversation that people have. And I looked around the room and I was like, oh, they're not kidding. This is something they've thought about. Okay, so how many of you in this room, and I'm asking them this question, not asking you, how many of you have thought about the end of the world? All of their hands went up, all eight of them, their hands went up. I said, how many of you think about it regularly? All of them. And I'm like, okay, what does regularly mean to you? And one kid is like, oh, every day. All the time I think about all the ways the world could end. And I was like, really? And every single one, to the one, said, yes, we think about this every single day. Three of them said it's their biggest fear is the world collapsing around them. And I looked around that room and I thought, wow, when I was a kid, we imagined that the future was going to be better than it was now. We were going to have better technology and cleaner world and less war and violence and more to live off of. We imagined a better world. They are incapable of imagining a better world. But it makes sense. It makes sense that their entire worldview is informed by apocalypse, because they're growing up in a world of mass shootings, of cataclysmic storms, of vast wildfires, mass extinctions, economic collapse, global pandemics. They're watching TikTok videos, first-person TikTok videos of kids their age living in the bombed-out rubble of their home. They saw the U.S. Capitol get invaded by their fellow Americans. They understand the stakes better than most of us realize that they do, and they're thinking about it all the time. They're taking this in, and they just can't bring themselves to imagine a better world than this one. And so it's no wonder that there is a mental health crisis among our youth, because they're paying attention, and it is hard to live through the apocalypse. Has nothing to do with their iPhones and social media, by the way. As much as we would say, you know, back in my day, we had sticks and we were fine, and their phones are making them depressed. It's not that. It's that they're paying attention to the world around them. And I bring this up today, not because it directly relates to this story of what is happening to Jesus, but that it relates to what happened before this. In Mark 13, chapter we didn't read, in between last week when Jesus was, you know, interacting with the religious leaders who are using faith as a weapon, and then today, there is a dialogue that is called the Little Apocalypse, in which Jesus and his disciples are walking away from Jerusalem, and they look back and they see the splendor of the temple, and they go, woo-wee, isn't it gorgeous? And Jesus says to them, hey, pretty soon, every single stone will be turned to rubble. There will be nothing left of this in your lifetime. And then he goes on to describe this apocalyptic vision of the end of times, of persecution, of fire, of war, of pestilence, of famine, of all of these awful things. And he says, and I don't know when it's going to happen. Not even I know, only the Father knows. I just know that it's coming soon. So that's chipper, right? And these people are already living in this with this apocalyptic fervor. The most popular genre of book at the time is apocalypse. People are imagining the end because they think they're in the end. It can't possibly get any worse than where they are. And when people believe that they are living in the end, do you know what happens? We get scared. We get afraid. And do you know what happens when we get scared as humans? Humans who are scared circle the wagons, and they double down on all the things that make them sure of their identity, of their inness, and of the outness of others. We separate more strongly when we feel scared and when we feel that there are scarce resources. It's almost like we feel like there's not going to be enough for everyone, so we have to make sure that the people that are in our inner circle are the most inner circle. These are when the times are most divided, which I don't know if you've noticed. Things are pretty divided in the U.S. right now because we are scared. Because we look around and we think we are in the apocalypse and we are scared. We are scared of scarcity. We are scared for our own security, for our own future. We're having a very hard time imagining a better future right now. So let's look at this passage again with that in mind. Imagining a people who are scared of the future, who believe they are in the end of all things, who have just had this conversation about it. So like I said, Jesus had caused trouble in the temple, and he told his people that not only is he about to die, but everything that they have ever known about their way of life, their religion, everything is about to change. Then they, a group of itinerant vagrant day workers who have lived in poverty for several generations, walk into a home of luxury. We know nothing much about them. I know that some people like to imagine that she pulled out this alabaster jar and it was like a family heirloom and it was the one thing of value that she had, but Mark doesn't say anything about that. It's almost like it's not a big deal for her. She pulls out this ointment, which the disciples say, wow, you could have sold this for 300 denarii, which a denarii is a day's work. So that's a year's wages. So imagine, if you will, Jesus walks into this very nice mansion and the host pulls out a $50,000 bottle of wine and opens the wine from 1720 or whatever and pours it out in Jesus's glass and goes, drink, drink. This is a celebration. How would you feel? Can you imagine that feeling? Then the disciples see this happening, and they are already living in this fearful scarcity mindset, and so they suddenly are so concerned about identity. This woman is not one of us. Clearly, she's not one of us. If she was one of Jesus' followers, she would know that we don't do this sort of thing. We care for the poor. We're the better people, morally speaking. We care about the poor. The rich people don't. They're our enemy. She very clearly is not one of us. You notice that that's the first thing they do? The first thing they do is go to, she's not one of us. They're scared, aren't they? Reminds me very much of what my Facebook feed looked like after the Super Bowl. Most people that I know didn't care about the game, but they cared a lot about the Jesus Gets Us people who spent millions of dollars on a Super Bowl commercial. And nearly everyone that I know who is of the kind of progressive mind just complained that how many people could you have fed with the money you spent on that Super Bowl commercial? And I'm looking through my feed and I'm like, oh my gosh, that's the line that Judas says. You're literally quoting Judas right now. But of course they were, because we're scared. We're living through frightening times where we feel like resources are scarce and the future is uncertain. And maybe you can relate too. Maybe you are scared of the future. Maybe you're having a hard time imagining a better tomorrow. And if you are, what can we do? How can we better live than living in a mindset of scarcity? And I'm not going to tell you that scarcity is an illusion and that we actually do have everything we need and everything's going to be fine, because there's still people that are starving. So it's clearly not true. But what can we do to live better in the midst of what feels like the end? Well, I have a suggestion. I have one suggestion for you. I'm sure there's a million answers to that, but I have one suggestion. And in order to explain it to you, we need to go back to the last great apocalypse. The last time that humanity faced what literally was the end of the world. And that took place 42,000 years ago. 42,000 years ago. There's still Neanderthals walking around. There's still woolly mammoths around. Humanity, Homo sapiens, we are a small species at that point, but we are genetically, physiologically, exactly the same as today. So, you and I. But 42,000 years ago, the magnetic poles of the Earth shifted. The North Pole became the South Pole. The South Pole became the North Pole, which, unless you have a compass, most people wouldn't have realized that the poles shifted. But while they were shifting, something really dramatic happened. The magnetosphere of the Earth diminished to maybe 10% of its strength. And fascinatingly, some Australian researchers found trees from this time period that had been so well preserved underground that they still had the bark on them, and they're able to look at the rings and see what happened in those days, take samples of the rings to see what the atmosphere was like in those days, what the temperature, I'm always amazed at what people are able to do. But what they found was that 42,000 years ago, the magnetosphere disappeared. And the magnetosphere is what stops really dangerous cosmic rays from pelting the Earth. And so what happened was, almost overnight, auroras began appearing in the sky, like colorful flashes of light in the daytime, in places of the world that had never seen it before. So imagine 42,000 years ago, you were living and you look up and there is just fire in the sky, constant fire. And without the magnetosphere, if you are in direct sunlight, you will burn because of the UV rays. And I don't mean like you get a sunburn, I mean boils. And I mean your skin starting to literally burn. Cancer is everywhere because of this. And all of those UV radiation, it changes the cloud formation, it changes the temperature. Suddenly the world gets way colder. This is when all of the sort of mega-sized mammals, like those giant sloths and all of that, that's when they all go extinct. There are mass extinctions in the world. The climate completely changes. The sun is no longer safe. The plants aren't growing. There is nothing to eat. And what do humans do 42,000 years ago in the midst of the apocalypse? Well, they found safety in caves. And so they're huddled together in these cave systems in the dark with just their immediate family, afraid to go outside. And what do in the caves? They make art. This is when there is an explosion of cave art across the entire world. Not just the fancy ones we find in France, but all over the world. Humans, no matter where they are, 42,000 years ago, retreat into caves and create art in the midst of the apocalypse. And there is something so human about that, right? That in the midst of the end, we create beauty. This is what humans do. We create art because it forces us to focus on the moment right now. to not live in the what if of the future, but to live in the thing that we are currently making. It forces us to imagine something that doesn't currently exist and to take that thing from our mind and to give it shape and form and reality. Creating art is a holy practice and one that is absolutely essential to being human. But the problem is that most of us have been taught that art is only worthwhile when it's able to be shown on Instagram or sold on Etsy. So I can see some of you sitting here thinking, sure, and this is great for an artist, someone like Candy, sure, but I can't even draw stick figures. I'm not a creative person at all. I don't have a creative bone in my body. I know some of you are thinking that because some of you have told me that. But that, friends, is a lie. And that is a lie that somebody along your life made you believe, most likely while they were trying to shove you into a box that you've never felt comfortable in. The truth is that we are creative beings created in the image of the Creator. You have a painting in you, or a poem, or a song, or a dance, or a remodeled bathroom, or however your creative spark flows. It is in you and it needs release. Because here's why. Art is the best way that we have found to name the unnameable things which keep us up at night. Art is how we give shape to the formless fears around us so that we can deal with them. As Mr. Rogers was fond of saying, anything human can be mentioned, and anything that has been mentioned can be managed. Here, can I show you my favorite cave painting? There are some really beautiful cave paintings. I don't know if you've looked too much at it. Some of them of these gorgeous animals that are now extinct. There are some really beautiful portraits of people. There's one that they discovered that looked like really bad art at the time. It's got all these weird lines in it, but then they discovered that if you look at it under torchlight, it's animated, right? There's some incredible things that humans did down there, but my favorite of all of them is a series of them, and these show up all over the world, that are simply hands. Right? Candy's with me this whole time. A human being put their hand on a wall and then blew paint through a straw and left a simple outline of their hand. I could do that. I could do that right now. I'm not here, but 42,000 years ago, a human being just like me lifted their hand up and said, I matter. My existence is important enough to leave my mark here. And in the face of global catastrophe, our ancestors found ways to create such lasting, profound beauty, and that is what has kept us going as a species. So what do you think? We have a few minutes. Are you feeling afraid? Are you feeling those apocalyptic vibes that my middle schoolers are feeling? Are you afraid? Are you finding yourself being more tribal than usual? What is your creative outlet? And do you agree that this is one of the ways that we can thrive in these times?